listening.
And we're all
hello and welcome to Hum and Kip Knows Best. We Kip a Micah.
And I'm Hum, we're a Micah.
And we're obviously Micahs.
And ironically, they're not unkempt.
They're not un-what?
Kemp.
You're and you're Kemp, right. And the both of you are bikers, yet you're not unkempt. Unkempt means not tidy.
Oh, okay then. Well, there you go. Yeah. I gotta be schooled up in some of the lingo.
Yeah, you might have to put the messages over here, bro, and a bit of a definition because Māori is our first language.
Oh, okay.
That's my excuse. No.
Well, I wrote a dissertation and I still just used bloody, what do you call it?
Jargon?
Autocorrect?
Oh.
Yeah. I thought dissertation was like some kind of Chinese dessert.
Asians. Oh, yeah. Nice. Like in fluctuation.
Yeah.
It's fluctuation. Anyway, have you heard that joke? This Samoan guy, it was this Chinese guy. He goes over to Samoa. And he went into the first dairy and he asks, excuse me, but how much is that coconut over there, please? And the dairy owner, he goes, this is my best Samoan accent. He goes, that's about 20 cent, please. Oh, I just go to the next dairy and see if I can get it. But how much it costs over there? That was the Chinese guy, sorry. So he goes into the next dairy. Goes, excuse me, how much is your coconut, please? And the dairy owner goes, it's about 25 cent. Yeah, 25 cent. Hold on. I go next dairy. This goes to the next dairy. Excuse me. Can I have a coconut, please? How much? It's a 30 cent, thanks. 30 cent. And Chinese guys. Why is it 5 cent if a dairy? It's called inflation. No, it's not. It's called fluctuation. And the Chinese guys, no, fluck you, coconut.
See, I was driving down the back of New Lynn this one time, and I saw a couple of islanders there with a van with a big sign that said coconuts for sale. And I went, frack, that's racist. Wait, wait a second. Oh, they're actually selling coconuts.
Did you seriously think it was?
Well, just for a second. You know how you have that kind of preeminent flash, and you're like, oh my God, what the hell is going on here? Oh, wait a second. It's not as bad as I thought.
Well, let me introduce you to our listeners. This is Vinny Eastwood, and I listen to a show, try and listen to it every day, but it's actually during class time, so I could not be doing it then. I don't listen to it. I listen to it after school. Anyway, just introduce yourself to our listeners, please.
Well, I'd say that when you listen to it after school, that's when the actual schooling begins, and the rest of it's all BS. Or at least that's been my experience of high school, primary school, university, higher education, the workplace, much protesting, much volunteer groups and everything. Basically, unless you're doing something by yourself that's totally original, you ain't really doing anything of value, and you're probably not going to learn terribly many lessons of value either, whilst within that constrained frame. And this is a very sad realization that happened to me. I was thinking about becoming a filmmaker, and I went to uni. My very first job was actually writing and directing my own play on Waiheke Island. I wrote it, directed it, produced it, got all the, there were like 14 actors or something in it. Incidentally, all of them were all my friends, and incidentally, the top actors on the island. So got it done, raised me all the money I needed to drive all the frack way down to Dunedin so I could start going to Otago University to learn film and media. And guess how much film and media I learned? Nothing. I did learn, however, when I got busted for selling cannabis when I was down there with 13 grams, that that's actually a jailable offence. You know, if you're selling weed to somebody, you've got it rolled up in tinnies or whatever, even if it's 13 grams, you can go to jail for up to 8 years. Yeah, they treat it more seriously than manslaughter, bro. And Yeah. My mum got into massive debt to bail me out. All my friends just basically disappeared. They weren't my friends. They were just coming around to smoke weed. You know, you suddenly your whole reality implodes on you, and you suddenly go from this really naive kind of thinking, oh, everything's going to be right. People aren't deceptive. People aren't thieving scum and so on and so forth. Meanwhile, I get like 10 grand worth of stuff nicked out of me from my room or my flatmates while I'm away with a weekend with my mum after all of this happens. I get assaulted in my room by one of my flatmates and so on and so forth. Really raw deal, man. And me for 13 grams of cannabis, I wound up with 300 hours community service. I was really lucky because the cops didn't advise me of my rights before they took my full confession.
True.
Yeah. So inadmissible as evidence. And then the guy in front of me in court was up for sexual assault, resisting arrest, and 5 cannabis plants. He got 150 hours community service.
What?
Yeah. It's quite odd. And the person in front of him was charged with stealing a jar of crazed jam. It looked like he'd just gone out of heroin rehab or something. And he was charged with stealing a jar of Craig's raspberry jam to the value of $4.26 or something like that from the local BP service station. And he was ordered by the court with all the lawyers and everything, you know, coming in to prosecute this guy from the BP Corporation to repay the $4.26 for the replacement of the jar of Craig's jam.
Whereabouts in Dunedin were you, bro?
The Northeast Valley during that incident, but I lived on Cargill Street, just kind of just overlooking the city kind of thing. It was bloody cold, man. Like, it was on average, I had like a temperature gauge on my G-Shock watch that somebody gave me for Christmas many years ago. And it was on average 5 degrees colder inside than it was outside. Yeah. I'd wake up in the morning... And there'd be a layer of condensation on my mink blanket. Like, seriously, there's actually water on my mink blanket that I'm sleeping under, right? I had one of the struts in my bed being held up by a bear crate, you know, real Dunedin style, except it adjusted it just a little bit too much, so I wound up with this twinge in my back. There were mushrooms growing out of the walls of the house and that kind of thing. The hallway was starting to sink in, sort of like a half pipe. You know, give it 50 more years, they can do the next X Games there, bro. It'd be sweet as. We had mold encrusting the entire ceiling of the bathroom there, no ventilation. We had a weatherboard missing off the front of the house and let all the draft through and everything. It snowed once while we were down there, and we got about maybe 30 minutes of sunshine from between 10 o'clock in the morning until about 10:30 a.m. and then the sun was gone for us on our side of the street, and the rest of the street got it all. So the one time that it snowed down there was still snow on our front lawn about 6 months later. it was cold, man. Like people say to me, oh, I've been in cold climate, you don't know what you're talking about. It's like, really, bro? Have you seen your olive oil freeze at room temperature yet?
No way, they're cold, bro.
Yeah.
Yeah, we used to live just across the road and from the library down. Yeah, and man, it was freezing. I remember waking up in the morning, walking down our corridor in Dunedin, and it was just like the walls were pissing down with water, all the condensation that, you know, and we still had to pay like fucking $100. It was like, so we used to cram quite a few of us, you know, there's heaps of people doing it. You know, just cram 3 or 4 people in a bloody room.
Well, they got the big rooms that are impossible to heat. One time our little fireplace didn't have a proper grill or whatever, and it took like, bought $30 of coal, burned it, and it kept the room warm for 3 hours, and then that was it.
Yeah, shit, all right.
Yeah, some hard times. But I needed those hard times, and I think that's that's part of my philosophy, is that we all need hard times in order to change the things that we're doing and the things that we're going through. If you don't strength test, say, a building or a bridge or some kind of construction implement, if you don't test what its limits are, you'll never know whether or not it's safe. And as a person, you know, you've got to put yourself into, or rather, if you've been fortunate enough to be in situations where you've had people that are close to you betray you, that you've had all your money stolen off you or all your items of personal ownership, if you've had your the course of justice subverted and so on and so forth. All of these really terrible experiences do different things to people. Some people get activated. They see the life of what it is and they go out and they fight against it and they dedicate the rest of their lives to destroy the very scumbaggery that was the affliction. That's kind of what happened to me. What happens to other people is they blame man itself.
Kevin.
They blame everybody for what happened to them. It was their personal choice to be in that situation a lot of times. Sometimes it's not their choice. But the thing is, if it ain't your choice, it ain't your fault, and you shouldn't be blaming yourself or everybody for it. And they never grow up. They never develop proper coping mechanisms. They never figure out that laughing about really terrible things that happen to you is a very healthy response. They take everything too seriously. They take themselves too seriously. They take everything that you say about them personally. And they're impossible.
Then they go and shoot up a school. Sorry.
Well, no, they'd have to be taking Prozac or some other kind of psychotropic drug, which every single major school shooting in the US has in common, is they're all on huge masses of psychotropic drugs that actually say on the warning label, may cause murder-suicide. All right?
Shit. It actually says that on the warning label.
Yeah. It's one of the possible side effects, you know. Here's this, it'll alleviate your depression. Yeah. Really, what are the side effects? Well, you might kill yourself and other people.
Suicidal.
Okay, well, it sounds worth the risk, doesn't it? and the other thing that all the school shootings have in common as well is they all happened in gun ban zones. There have been a number of attempted...
Gun ban.
Yeah. So nobody's armed. There have been a number of attempted school shootings at schools that don't have gun bans, where some of the teachers have guns in their desk and so on and so forth. The gunman was shot before he could kill a single innocent soul.
Do you reckon it'll ever happen here, bro?
Oh, it's already happened. Didn't we have some dude down in the South Island or something like that shoot up a bunch of people, like, years and years ago kind of thing?
Yeah, and that was from that movie, the... Into the Blue
Some guy in a small beach community or whatever had a couple of weapons, and what happened with that incident
Aramoana, I think.
That rings a bell. And he had a number of things that would be classed as quote-unquote assault weapons, repeating rifles, so on and so forth. And at the time, it was perfectly legal for people to have weapons like that, except he had them illegally. So he broke the law in order to possess these weapons and the capacities and what have you than they have there. But after he was arrested or killed or whatever the fuck happened to him, then they decide that everybody's the enemy. Everybody needs to now have a safe bolted to the wall and floor in order to secure their firearms from anybody else, even though nobody stole this guy's firearms or went on a rampage with him. And this is part of a global anti-gun agenda that the UN is spearheading to take away people's rights to defend themselves. Now, you can't name me a single civilization or culture or country throughout the entirety of history that had gun bans where the population wasn't enslaved or exterminated. Okay, even way back to Edward the Longshanks, he banned weapons for the Scottish because he wanted to kill and enslave them. And this is a long-running history of disarming people. And I don't know if you've ever talked to any gun owners, but frack, they're very, very safe people. They're often very... say paranoid, but maybe a little overly cautious about their firearms safety, who they talk to about them, that
kind
of thing.
Would you say passionate?
Absolutely passionate. And the thing is, they're also very afraid to speak out, because anybody who starts demonizing gun control automatically gets this really wonderful fanfare or whatever to help them, you know, oh, we need to get guns off the streets, they're really bad and what have you. And they're not States, sure, you have 11,486 gun deaths per year, but the gun deaths are very minimal when you compare them to about 200,000 prevented crimes of rape, assault, murder, and so on and so forth that are actually presented by merely the pointing of a firearm. 98.something% of people never even discharge their firearm, and only like 1% of those people who do discharge their firearm are even aiming at the person, you know? So we've got a paranoid sort of response
society,
to guns.
Yeah.
And self-defense and anything. I mean, you heard this about this some guy who was getting
everything.
His quad bike stolen from some hoodlum or whatever. Oh. He's stealing your private property, and you can't even take a shot at him when he's stealing your property on your property. You know, that strikes me as freaking insane. Man's home is his castle. That seems perfectly reasonable, doesn't it? If you're doing something illegal or unlawful, or you're trying to kill somebody, then you should be able to defend yourself. However, that's a bit of a risque case because his life wasn't actually under threat. They were just going to steal the quad bike and take off. They weren't busting into the house. They weren't trying to hurt him or his family. So there's a little bit of a leeway there to this type of legislative action that might be taken. But, you know, it doesn't matter at the end of the day when you come to that realization that every single time when you ban guns for the average people and only the soldiers and cops can have them, the soldiers and cops with absolute monopolistic force power kill and enslave everybody. It happens every single time. Lithuania, China, Russia, Germany,
New Zealand.
We haven't been totally, like, forcefully, ruthlessly enslaved just yet. You don't see them killing people left, right, and centre, do you? Just yet.
Well, just left.
Because we've still got a lot of guns in this country. We've got almost... did you know that there's actually more guns per capita in Canada than there is in the US? And we've got comparable amount of gun ownership here in New Zealand. Lots of farmers have multiple rifles, 22s, 308s. I don't know, some of them might even have shotguns and so on and so forth. The point where a domestic insurrection is impossible is when all of those kind of personal weapons that can actually fight back against an invading force are taken from people. And what people don't realize is that the invading force invariably happens to be your government, not other countries.
Oh yeah, absolutely agreed with that, right? Absolutely agree with that.
Wow. When we were down Dunedin, one of my mates' mother represented Tamaiti in them on the Tuhoe raids, you know, and then it was just so funny how, you know, those charges that they laid against them were just ones.
Seven out of the nine of those warrants issued were ruled by Chief Justice Winkleman to be unlawful. Chief Justice Winkleman sealed that judgment so that the media would not be allowed to report on it. Somebody called Vince Seymour from KiwisFirst.co.nz, noted judicial watchdog, was jailed just recently, went to jail for 3 weeks for reporting that happened. Because you should be allowed to report on important frickin' details, like the government's breaking its own law and the courts are covering it up, for example. And incidentally, John Key has just recently said that he will prevent any investigation into judicial corruption under his term in government. I wonder why.
That's awesome.
Yeah, fuck, that's awesome. It's fucking awesome how you can make up your own rules, Amy. Just imagine if we could do that.
The thing is, I could sit here and hyperbolize everything about this government and say that it's the most corrupt ever, they're killing people left, right, and center, and they got bioweapons in the water supply, and so on and so forth. I could actually literally make bad stuff up in my head, and 90% of the time wind up being correct. That's the terrible truth about this country. People are like, oh, it's nice, you know, you got the Maldives and grass skirts, and you got the beautiful fucking mountains next to the water, bro. Oh, it's wonderful, you know, we'll come over there for a holiday and get kidnapped by some guy while I'm hitchhiking along the fucking road. Yeah. Oh, it's beautiful.
And then get here and then find out that fucking like 90% of our rivers, lower land, are all fucking polluted.
Yeah, you know why? Yeah. I was like sitting in a car with Kaumatoa. He took me down to the Tikawiti Temple of the Four Winds. The English burned it down back in the day, right? And a very sacred place to them. And I'm the first journalist to ever in this country's history be invited down there. Very, very fucking honored to be there, bro. Yeah.
Awesome, bro.
And they were telling us, what was interesting is when we were in the car, you know, those graveyards sometimes on the side of the road and whatever? He always toots the horn of his car and says, g'day, bros. You know, I found the Kaumata are very, very connected to the spiritual side of the human being. You know what I'm saying? Like that kind of shit hasn't been drummed out of their generation yet, not entirely anyway. And he was talking about when he was a farmer, and you needed to keep your cows away from the river. Okay, at least 50 meters away from the river at all times. And at night, you take them up the hill, good 150 meters away minimum, in order to keep any effluent from going into the river. And when we're driving through Otorohanga on our way to Tikawiti, we see the fence lines right up on the side of the road. On the other side of the fence is the fucking river that the cows are walking and shitting in.
Out of it, eh, bro.
That's how it is, man. That's how it is.
See, that's what happens when you give it to corporate scumbaggery interests who have no interest in maintaining the land or a custodian title or anything like that. There's a number of Māori organisations. One guy in particular talked at a socialist meeting that I was at, where they've been given control of like nearly 1,000 lakes and rivers around New Zealand, right? Yeah. And guess how many of those rivers is currently clean? Every single one of them. The government has control of the rest of the lakes and rivers. Guess how many of them is clean? Not a fucking one of them, okay? This is the difference between Māori custodianship and government custodianship. Government is run by companies, okay? Companies don't give a fuck about the land. They're keen on making a quick buck. They don't care. You know, they'll come in with their fracking operations. They'll pollute the water table so that nobody can fucking live there, and then you got to go live in the megacity slave block somewhere. Yeah. They don't give a fuck.
But that's like Waihee too, you know, when they put done all the mining and shit there, you know, you get online and have a look at there. I think that's the Watchdog, you know, and a lot of what they've posted on there, it's full on, eh? You know, they said that they were going to go there and then that, you know, there'll be ample jobs, and then they established it and they've got a worse, like, I think, unemployment rate than Pairoa, which is, you know, right next door to Waihee. And I think they've got they almost got a lower population.
Pairoa?
It's something like that anyway, but it's full on, eh? That's what they do.
Yeah. I mean, and you've got two general assumptions for life that I follow. One, if it comes from an official source of some kind, then it's probably the direct opposite of whatever they're telling you, the exact opposite. So if they say they're going to create jobs, oh, they must be trying to create poverty and unemployment. Oh, okay. If they say they're trying to create trade deals because it'll be better for the economy, it's like, oh, they're creating trade deals so that foreign corporations can seize control of our country and fuck us all and deprive us of any income or resources that actually belong to this freaking country through the TPPA and so on and so forth. If they tell you that the medical system is there to heal you, then obviously they must be there to kill you. And incidentally, that's actually true. The Ministry of Health is now officially, according to their own records, the second leading cause of death in New Zealand. That's not including all the unreported vaccine reactions and unreported this, the unreported that and the other and that kind of thing. They're there to sell poisons, yo. Hospitals. Sorry, go ahead.
That isn't it funny how they called it the health system?
Yeah. Well, Edward Bernays was the father of propaganda. He was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. If you want to learn about Edward Bernays, look about the documentary called The Century of Self. Very, very interesting thing. He's the person who got suffragettes to smoke. You know, the women who were campaigning to give women the vote and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
He got to some of those high-class ladies to smoke cigarettes while they're in a protest and called them torches of freedom. And before you knew it, the tobacco companies had a huge female customer base that just lumped up out of there. He's the person who got a waste pork product known as bacon that was never eaten or enjoyed by people because it was too fatty and gross. He said, you can't have your eggs in the morning without your bacon. And now all of a sudden bacon and eggs is a huge freaking popular meal. He told people all these things, and he wrote a book called Propaganda. He's literally the man who wrote the book on propaganda. He's the man who told the United States Department of War, No, don't call yourself the Department of War. Call yourself the Department of Defense.
Peace.
Ah, so now the trick starts to come out. Every single time you see these people doing what they're doing and saying what they're saying, it doesn't match up. And that's because it's deliberate. They know how to manipulate people into supporting things that are against their interests.
Yeah. Absolutely, brother.
But, man, and that brings, like, I was just thinking about that and I don't... like, because I got two twin boys, you know, and when they walk, even just the right down to the layout and shops and fucking everything, yeah, man. Bro. I walk in there and then they have all the bloody chocolates and everything on the same height as my kids, you know, and then they've got all these colorful bloody
and the
all
music.
Of the lollies and all of the fucking Powerade's the greatest thing for
They're
you.
They're doing everything but pumping synthetic pheromones through the motherfucking ventilation, yo. Which they do in, I believe they do that in some Las Vegas casinos. They actually pump pheromones through the fan system in order to make people calmer, so that they don't freak out when they're losing all their money and go back from the table, to actually keep them intensely interested. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's just like how they diagnose all the ADHD kids with medication, so they're kept down and they're...
Oh, you can't concentrate? Here, kid, here's a watered-down version of fucking cocaine.
There you go, man.
If there's one thing that's good for a child, it's fucking cocaine.
Absolutely.
Feed them up. I mean, what does ADD mean? Well, I remember that somebody accused me of being ADD once, and it's like a four-part story. All right, so firstly, my mother gets suggested by my guidance counselor at school that I'm ADHD, and then she gets this pamphlet that has all these symptoms and stuff on it that says, low attention span, always doing other things, you know, a bit of fiddling, a lot of creativity, a lot of intelligence, a lot of this, that, and the other, and whatever. You know, it could have fit anybody, really.
Yeah.
And then my mum's like, no, I don't think we'll do that, and we'll go do a test. So we go to this doctor in Howick, right, and have a test. And it's just this stupid little computer program, like how fast is your reaction time? Like, can you it reads, you know, click the space bar or something like that, and then it gauges how fast it takes you to actually click that shit. And then I was just like, okay, that's fine. Do this test, and don't know what the score means or anything. So I go into the doctor, and he asked me this question. I'll never forget it. He says, did you have a father in the home for all or most of your life? And I said, no, actually my dad went when he was 10. Oh, yep, you're probably ADHD then. And I was like, whoa, hold on a second. If this is a disease, how does my father being in a relationship have something to do with it? And then later on, a friend of mine tells me that ADD stands for attention dad disorder. For men that don't have good contact with their fathers, they have difficulty controlling their functions, their brains, and so on and so forth, because what happens is when you're born, you imprint on your male and female role models. That's why a lot of men, when they go out and date women, they date women that are actually a lot like their mothers, and a lot of women that go out and date men that are actually a lot like their fathers, because you get imprinted. If you don't have the imprinting plus the raising, then your brain doesn't know how to cope with it, kind of thing. This is my theory, and you can substitute that, and that's what my mother did. She hired a guy named Derek Haywood, who ran a Waiheke Blue Lavender Farm. Really, really cool guy. I got to hang out once a week and just do guy stuff and what have you. And suddenly, I stopped being violent. I started having a better attention span and so on and so forth. Just having that positive influence around. Mm. And then the last part of the story was when I was in university, in business school, and they put up the slide on the thing, and they had the very same symptoms of ADHD on that slide in business school. And do you know what they were describing? An entrepreneur. And I was like, whoa, hold on a second. Does that mean that entrepreneurs who are creative people, who have a strong will, who are capable of making things frickin' happen and changing the way people think about things, changing the way the world works, are the ones that have been targeted to get addicted to drugs that turn you into a frickin' zombie as early as freaking possible so that they cannot threaten the established order? One of my friends gave me an ADHD pill at university, you know, just to try out. And then I went to work, and instead of thinking my normal like 11 different thoughts and subjects all at the same time and all over the place, but really kind of bringing it together sort of thing, you know, like a rapper who's got a dictionary above his head and only words come out, it became like nothing. I was like looking up in my head, just going, "There's nothing. There's no creativity there. There's no joy, there's no fear, there's no love, there's there's nothing. That was what it felt like to me. It felt like I was a freaking zombie just kind of walking around doing the automaton thing. And that was very a profoundly scary experience for me, because I'd grown up to feel and know who I am by my thoughts, by my mind. And this thing managed to turn it off with just a little pill. And they're doing that to kids as young as 6 months old in the States. Now, seriously, a kid was, not for ADHD, I think. Maybe it was depression or whatever. An infant was diagnosed as depressed, and they put her on frickin' some kind of psych, like Prozac or frickin' whatever the hell. You know, we're just like living in a world where there's a pill for every ill. It's incidentally another Edward Bernays quote. Or at least I think he helped with the marketing campaign of that, because the Rockefeller Foundation had a lot of pharmaceutical contracts and what have you. They did this thing called the Flexner Report back in the late 1800s. They sent this dude around Flexner, right? At the time, you know how much you get paid for being a doctor, like per day? It was like a dollar. You know, doctors were cheap as chips. They were practically volunteers. So Flexner gets sent around at the behest of the Rockefeller Foundation to all of these different medical schools all around the country. You know, herbalists, naturopaths, medical doctors, psychiatry, and so on and so forth. And what he does is freaking horrific. He grades them as being very good or not very good. And all the ones that he graded not very good got shut down by the government. And all of those ones that got shut down were everything other than the allopathic medicine, which is the drug and the pill for every ill. So all of the other medicine disciplines and so on and so forth, herbalists, what have you, they were all out of the job. And the only thing people left with was drugs. They did the same thing to the Māori when they passed the Taonga Suppression Act. All the traditional medicines, everything that Māori used to control disease since they came to this freaking country was wiped out. Okay, and there's only a few practitioners left to my knowledge, and there's a desperate need for a resurgence in that, let alone the destruction to language and so on and so forth, because that's how they conquer people, man. If you can't speak the frickin' language, you're not going to identify with the culture, are you? Not anywhere near as good as you could.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and I suppose that's where our influence from our parents were, full on the rejuvenation of te reo Māori, and our mother, she put together a whole big book, actually, and took all the photos of all the trees, because right where we are now, it was right in the middle of the bush, pretty much, and there was a lot of that, and we always heard, I suppose, the conversations that went on around our table were very, very different.
Absolutely.
When I look back on it, you know, they were very, very different from the average household, I would say.
Yeah.
And very political, you know.
Very aware. A spiritual, very spiritual. Our father was, he was very well known in the community, but very known as an eccentric man. He was the one who actually brought us up when we were babies. So it went against the grain. Our dad was the mum at home, the stay-at-home mum. And mum went out to work, and she was the teacher and paid all the bills. And that's kind of putting it real simple.
Well, it just went against the grain, really, what typical society says a male Māori should be. Yeah. You know, he should be working in the fucking forestry, providing putting the bacon, whatever.
Bringing home the bacon,
beating his wife, all that sort of shit, going down the pub.
Beating his kids up.
Our dad was quite the opposite, and he copped a lot of shit for it, eh?
Yeah. Mm.
And I mean, and just that's why what resonates for me when you're talking is about, having those male role models, for male kids, because I'm teaching in a Māngere at the moment, and there's such a huge need for it. Well, and then when you look at the stats, it's like, well, of course there's a fucking need for it, because we're at the bottom of the heap.
Yeah, have a look at the prison stats, man. I mean, if you don't have a father in
half of the prisoners.
Yeah. Well, I think
we're related to half of them.
Well, yeah, so 80% Māori or between 50% and 80%, I think somewhere around that region, you're nine times more likely, if you're a Māori man, to go to jail for the same offence as a Pākehā man.
Yeah.
You are 7 times more likely to wind up with a criminal conviction if you don't have a father in your house for all or most of your life. You know? These are very stark, very startling kind of straight up statistics. And you know what you can really kind of blame? You know, I'll piss a lot of women off by saying this, but the introduction of feminism into society.
In many ways, yeah. Definitely. Right.
Now,
in many
ways. Yeah, there's an old saying, follow the money. You ever heard of Deep Throat? The guy who exposed a whole bunch of stuff. He was the guy who led Woodward and Bernstein, the guys who brought out the fact that Richard Nixon was into a thing. Follow the money, right? Who financed feminism? Well, it turns out it was financed by the Rockefeller Corporation. Huh, how interesting. Who financed the most prestigious feminist magazine in the world? Well, it looks like the CIA was behind it. How interesting. And there's a guy named Aaron Russo. Have you ever seen the movie with Eddie Murphy, Trading Places, with Dan Aykroyd?
Yeah.
He produced that film. And he made a couple of documentaries called Mad as Hell and America from Freedom to Fascism. He made the classic documentaries about the case of how the US government was being taken over. And he had a personal relationship with Nicholas Rockefeller, and they have a conversation this one time. And Nicholas Rockefeller says to him, "Hey, Aaron, do you know what feminism was about?" And he's pretty naive at the time. And he says, "Yeah, I thought it's really good. You know, they give the women more rights and the right to work and that kind of thing is fine." And Rockefeller laughs at him and he says, "You know what, you're an idiot." And he goes, "Why? Why am I an idiot?" He says, "We funded that for two main reasons. There was half of the population currently that we couldn't tax. That's one reason. And to break up the family. If you break up the family unit and you get both parents out to work, it means that the kids get put into state care, like the high school systems or the daycare and so on and so forth, where the government can actually dictate the protocols of what they learn. In so doing, people develop a loyalty not to their parents as their teachers and guides through life, but to the state. Hitler did this. The very first piece of legislation that Nazi Germany passed that discriminated against a specific group of people wasn't the Jews, wasn't the blacks, wasn't the gays, wasn't the disabled people. It was homeschoolers.
Shit.
And that's why they had the Hitler Youth and everything. And this is what's happening now. I spoke to Ian Wishart from Investigate Magazine once. I had him on the show. And he was talking about how his boy was in class and they were teaching them about global warming and the UN and how it's great and all of that kind of stuff. And Ian Wishart's boy gets up and he says, "Well, I think the UN is a global government organization trying to kill and enslave us." And he was like, "That's my boy." But at the end of the day, that was Ian Wishart's son in that one very classroom being able to speak the truth towards one teacher on one particular subject. There aren't that many children like that in the public schools today. And gradually but surely every single child is being brainwashed in order to see the state as their chieftain.
Yeah. Yep. And that's infiltrated into our Kura Kaupapa system to an extent too, you know?
Yeah, it's starting to get that way within the Kura Māori and the Kura Kaupapa.
What they do is they come in and they bribe your leaders, okay? They say, "We'll give you this," or "This is going to be good for your people," or this and that and the other such and stuff. You don't want to do any business with the government if you're a social organization, in my opinion, because they're just too corrupt. They wind up taking it over every single fracking time, and they wind up getting people in their pocket. And once you're in their pocket, you ain't ever getting out. It's like Bricktop off the movie Snatch. It's a very scary, scary individual that would go in, willingly lie to people, have the actual intention to deceive them and to also work about some kind of scheme in order to destroy your community and your culture. And if you start up a new group, a new kind of community, a new kind of culture, they'll infiltrate that too. Right. You know, it's one of the American founding fathers said, "The price of freedom is eternal vigilance." It's never been more true today than it was back then, man.
Yeah,
people are not vigilant. They're not seeing the scumbaggery agents of the New World Order coming into their towns, coming into their mayoral offices and so on and so forth. They're not seeing it because they ain't looking for it.
Yeah,
and
right.
You know what this reminds me of? We started off this conversation by saying who I am and what I do. We've just gone off on a tangent. You know, it happens.
Not, right. This is fucking the corridor we want to hear, you know? This is the kind of speak my brother and I talk about all the time, you know? And we just want to be able to share it with the rest of our peers as well, because we don't really get this chance to speak so candidly about how we were brought up. They see it from the outside, but they lack the detail, and it's not a judgment call or anything. It just does.
Yeah. Well, the details are really important, and I think I kind of got into what I'm doing. I'm a 5 day a week, 2 hour a day talk radio show host on an American network. I'm the first New Zealander to ever host an American based talk radio show because I know more about America than most Americans do, which is a sad indictment on the nation as a whole. I know more about New Zealand than most New Zealanders would ever hope to dream to know. Not because
that wouldn't be too hard for the majority of the Americans, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
No. I just got right in there, you know. In New Zealand, it's a similar case, unfortunately, because I've been trying to listen to other talk radio show hosts in New Zealand, and you know, there's some people who get it right, you know, some of the time, and some people who get it right only a little bit of the time. But on the whole, you look at the whole picture, we don't really have alternative media in this country, right? Nothing official, nothing grounded, nothing regular, nothing that's top in the charts, nothing that's really going into bat directly against the mainstream media for all it's worth, except me. For 10 hours a week, I'm giving New Zealand activists and commentators and researchers and former employees of, say, I don't know, the Secret Service, for example, a platform to speak on my radio show for up to 2 hours at a time, so you get all those precious details, all that precious perspective. Because if you don't have perspective, you don't even know where you are, let alone who you are, let alone how the hell you're going to get out of the situation, do you? And that's what people have forgotten, is that they're trying to over-specialize. I'm a doctor. Okay, you're a doctor. What kind of doctor? I'm a surgeon. So let me get this straight. You've spent 8 years, maybe 10 years, learning how to do what you do, and the best thing that you can do is only one skill, and that's cutting people open and removing stuff from them. Is that about right? Okay, so see, this is what happens when you over-specialize. You suddenly ignore, you have to ignore the entire world in order to understand one aspect really well so you can do it. Okay, and this is what's been really ragging on me for other people, because I'm not like that. I'm a generalist. I like to know a little bit about everything rather than everything about a little thing.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And
jack of all trades and master of none.
Yeah, exactly. And that's interestingly enough, you said that, because that was part of the 7-page essay that I wrote to my previous employer about how to actually run the company a lot better and more efficiently and have a lot more staff retention. That people in my position, the business account manager, should be a jack of all trades and a master of none kind of thing, to be able to help customers, especially important business customers, in order to do their thing, whereas really they were just glorified salespeople. And I didn't like that. I didn't want to be a salesperson anymore. My last paycheck was working for a Vodafone subsidiary. I got $4,000 cash and $11,900 worth of Westfield vouchers as a bonus for a month's work. And that was at the point where I was just like, frack this. I don't want to work for scum anymore. I don't want to work for psychopaths. I don't want anybody telling me what to do ever again in my entire life. I want to be able to go into a place where they're planning on paying me money, and if I don't like them, I walk out. I want that kind of freedom. And so I spent all that money on a Mac computer here and a camera, and I started going out and filming protests and what have you. You know, every protest you go to, anybody who's on a megaphone or a microphone at a protest, I can guarantee you interview that person, they will blow your fracking mind with the amount of information that they have to give you. This is why these people lead protests. This is why they speak at them, because they're very well-versed. As far as I was concerned, these people in New Zealand are the new reporters. New Zealand Herald went from, like, 95 reporters in late 1990s, and now they're down to like five, a couple of years ago. There is no investigative reporting going on in this country really anymore whatsoever, to a large degree, and the only people who are doing the investigation, who know what they're talking about, who are capable of saying whatever they want to you without fear of repercussion because they've already lost everything, is the activists. And I seek to give them a voice every single day that I'm alive, I will make sure that those people get heard, not because I have to, but because I don't have a choice, because there is a lack of options for people to go to. I have activists come to see me, Vinny, can I have you on my radio show? I mean, I don't mean to impose or whatever. And it's just like, impose upon me? Dude, I've got 10 hours of radio content to fill up every single week. And you think you're imposing by offering to fill a couple of hours of that with incredible information from this suffering and shit that you've gone through? How all these fucking pieces of trash that are running the government and running the country into the fucking ground are persecuting you because you're exposing their scumbaggery? I don't think you're imposing at all, son. If anything, it'd be imposing on me to say, to tell you to do it all the time or whatever. You've already made the choice. I can't order you around to do anything, just like nobody can order me around to do anything, because I will do what is right. I will take the oath of a knight. I will swear to tell the truth, to stand in honor, and to have absolute respect for life, and to expose scumbaggery wherever it might sit, even if it be in the House of Parliament, even if it be in the Committee for Auckland. I will expose it and make sure that the people who are doing that really important work, all that research that I'm too much of an inept fuck to do, I will make sure that they get heard, because at least they're doing the work that nobody in the fucking media is doing, and I'll just give them a platform, because nobody in the media is doing that for them either.
We're just talking, like before we come on, we're like, fuck, that's why Hone Haruwira doesn't really succeed, eh? Because fuck, he always gets his ass kicked and handed to him when he's fuck, you know, because, and that's why he broke away from the Māori Party. I mean, fuck, I've seen him down when he was protesting for when they were going to put the motorway, so they threw the housing in Auckland there. And fuck, he was sitting on the roofs, you know, he's right in there. He's always around, man, you know, you always see him. He's active.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, that's...
Well, his mother's a hardcore activist, isn't she?
Oh, hard, yeah, but she's fucking hardcore.
See, you know, your parents have such a massive imprint on your life. And what I find very interesting is that these very... what I call rugged individualists, who believe that because I can see the stars in the sky, that means all the knowledge of the world is open to me and all the situations can part ways. Yeah, that's not that case, bro. Those stars in the sky aren't going to fucking help you. There are situations that you're born into, you know. You might have violent parents who aren't employed. They're not providing good examples to you as a man or a future woman or whatever. And these things really... take a lot of time to get over. Like, I'm still not over my dad not being there for me, even though I've accumulated, I'd say, like, hundreds of father figures around, and like elder activists, honest, decent men who've built big companies and then had it all stolen away from them by government scumbaggery. People who've really kind of lived a rich, full life, who kind of play surrogate to my lack of a father figure in my own life, and I'm still not entirely over it. I'm making the best of a bad situation, but at the end of the day, it's left an imprint on me that I may not ever be able to get over, you know. And that's what people have to understand, is that the breakdown of the family unit is the breakdown of society.
Yeah.
Hell yeah, mate. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I mean, and that's like prevalent as within Māori society now, you know. As soon as the urban drift occurred, you know, and then there was that huge breakdown, and then they got assimilated into the city life and into being, you know, into the Western Laborers. Way of thinking and believing. And then, and that's what's, you know, I see that in the kids even at our school, you know, those sorts of notions and ideas that, you know, I'm not clever enough, or you know, and it's like, fuck, that's a load of shit, man.
Hegemony.
Yeah, hegemony, I think it is, yeah, or something like that.
Yeah.
But you know, and it still plays out, and you can't, well, it's just got such a lot to do with the breakdown of the family and the history of New Zealand, you know. It's just
the classic divide and conquer, you know. They absolutely succeeded in what they wanted to do. I mean, divide, conquer, smash them into the point where they actually believe the shit that we're telling you. You're dumb. You're dumb. Yeah. Oh, that's right. I'm dumb.
I think that's a great point to make, and I think it's also a good point to admit. I admit that I'm dumb. I admit that I don't know what I'm talking about. You know why? Because if I never admit it to myself, if I never question, am I being the idiot here, then I'll never find out whether or not I really
am.
I'm
an idiot. That's
if
right.
If I'm not questioning it, I'll probably become it. You know what I'm saying? It's the the ballad of the cosmic schmuck. Cosmic meaning big, schmuck meaning idiot. And there's this guy, initials R-A-W, Raw, and he had this quote and says, there's the ballad of the cosmic schmuck. If you're sitting there, and you're thinking to yourself, am I the cosmic schmuck? Then he says that you'll probably never become the cosmic schmuck. But if you're living your life, you never even just take that moment, just one moment out of your life. You have a look at how you're dressed or or where you're living or what kind of job you're in or what kind of friends you're hanging with or what kind of thing that you hope to do with the rest of your life and whether or not it's true. And you go, am I the cosmic schmuck? If you never do that, you'll never be able to course correct.
That's
you
right.
know, people have got to constantly admit, I'm dumb, I don't know what I'm talking about, and I don't know, and I'm so dumb that I don't know how dumb I really am. Please enlighten me. Please give me some information that'll actually be of value to me. Don't tell me lies. Don't tell me mismanaged operations of scumbaggery, okay? Just tell me the frickin' truth, okay? I can take it. I'm a grown person. You can swear if you want. I'm over 18. Fuck it. Just tell me the truth. I want to know what the fuck is going on here. Because if I don't know what the hell is going on, how in the fuck am I going to do anything about it? You know? And surprisingly enough, that's why nothing is being done. You know? Throughout the whole of society, everything just seems to be churning and getting worse and worse and worse and worse. Or at least that's the stuff that gets all the press coverage. You know, and that leaves a really sour taste in people's mouth. So they never think to yourself, you know, am I the cosmic schmuck by sitting here and actually not doing anything? Am I the cosmic schmuck because I'm posting on people's protest comments on Facebook or something like that, saying protesting never works, you'll never achieve anything, and I'll never come out and help you because I don't think that it achieves anything? Hold on a second, bro. Are you telling me that by not coming out and not doing anything of any kind, that you're going to achieve more than me?
What's that? That's the definition of insanity, isn't it? So doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting something different.
Yeah, it's like, I'm really surprised. I've been doing nothing all my life and I've got nothing to show for it. Fuck, that's confusing.
What? Why has it all changed?
You know, vote for the next person that campaigns on a platform of change, you know, see how that works out for you. You know, there's people who accuse me of being unprofessional. I'm like, bro, this world's currently run by professionals, isn't it? And they go, yeah. How's that working out for you?
Yeah. Famous Dr. Phil quote, eh? How's that working for you, buddy?
Yeah. And that's the thing. You got to do that bit of self-analysis and figure out where you fit in the world. You know, everybody's been endowed, or at least I believe, everybody's been endowed with innate talents and skills. Some people have had really bad vaccine reactions and have severe autism and they can't communicate or whatever. I'm not sure what they're capable of contributing. However, there have been cases where a couple of boys with autism went into a school and a couple of people took very, very close attention to them. And through intense repeating of things, really intense, like every single word, every single sentence, and so on and so forth, by the end of their school career, they were capable of speaking fluent English without so much as a stutter. And they gave a valedictorian speech thanking the people that taught them how to speak so that they could communicate, because as children, they weren't able to communicate, and that's why they're always having tantrums, that's why they're scratching and biting and hitting people, because nobody took the time to actually sit there and intensively educate them how to communicate properly, considering their disability. You know, how about them apples? Is that not a story of the triumph of the human ability, of the human spirit, of people who actually give a frack about one another? That's what happens when you actually care about one another. You know, there's three words that I really, really love. I don't know. And the three words I really, really hate. I don't care. And the three words that I think that are absolutely essential for personal growth. I was wrong.
Yeah, hard out. That's something that one of our nephews, his dad, has told him. He taught him, if you don't know, make it up.
Yeah, make
and
it
it's
up.
Like, and that's really fucked him up, because you know he will never admit that he's wrong, you know, and that's where, you know, it starts falling down. Like, you know, and I think a lot of it too is because that you get detached and from actual relationships from people when you start thinking like that. And, you know, I see some of the stuff that he gets up to, and there's a complete detachment, you know, from when he's talking and hurting people. Yeah. And that realization that you're actually hurting someone, you know, by even admitting just like, oh, maybe I was fucking wrong and maybe I did hurt you, you know. Yeah, a lot of that it comes into play too, even when I'm working, you know, you see it all the time, just those little things like that.
Mm. And because,
some people, yeah.
Well, just to clarify things, our nephew's father's Pākehā. So coming from his background, we do understand why he acts the way he acts. And I'm not saying all Pākehās are like this. It's just like a generalization that all Māoris should be going to jail and whatnot. But it has an element of truth in it. Like I think I'd rather call it a Western upbringing, you know, where you're told to suppress all your anger and suppress all your feelings and don't cry. Don't cry. A man doesn't cry. A man doesn't cry. Mm. So hold those feelings in and just wait for about 50 years until they blow up in your face.
Yeah.
I wonder why.
Well, the thing is, they don't blow up in your face in 50 years. They blow up in your face every day.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. If you're living with a denial, it's a constant trauma and it's constant anguish and constant pain until you deal with it. And it took me years to get over getting busted, to get over realizing university was a scam, to realize that every single employer that I've ever had was quite likely a clinically diagnosed psychopath. These kind of things were pretty intense and really harsh to deal with. And I think it was when I was listening to Alex Jones and hearing him get all really angry and uppity and screaming and so on and so forth. Something really awakened in me because I was actually just as angry as him. But I go about it a different way. And when I first went out, you know, going to protests and stuff like that, I was trying to be Alex Jones more or less, you know, I was yelling, screaming, angry and insults and talking about tyranny and scumbaggery and what have you. But now I've kind of, it's sort of like you come into your own after you imitate somebody else and you find out what your different take is on it, you know, similar message, just with a different methodology. And that's how you really make something your own, I think. And so now when I'm chanting protest and something like that, I'm clever, I'm witty, I'm making the whole crowd of protesters laugh with jokes through the megaphone and so on and so forth, as well as injecting really intensely interesting and I feel important information about how the country's going and who we are as people and what it is we're willing to fight for, what it is we're willing to die for. Because I don't think that if we do this gently, gently, softly, softly approach all the time, that we're going to achieve the results that we really need.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's plenty of people like that who don't want to tell you the whole truth, you know, straight up into your face. And my perspective is we're out of fucking time. Okay. We're living in a system that's being so vastly built up in every single area that the only way to fight it is as hard as we freaking can with every moment that we're alive. If we don't, it will probably beat us and enslave the entirety of humanity till the end of freaking time. Imagine that. Imagine a dark age, like in Judge Dredd, where everybody's stuck in a slave block, no bigger than an office desk, you know, that's your apartment to live in, that kind of thing. No freedoms. Everywhere you go, your eye scanned, face scanned, frickin' everything scanned, just to make sure that you're not going into any unauthorized zone, just to be sure that you're not doing anything you're not supposed to be doing. Just a complete and utter state of human darkness, servitude, brainwashing, mind control even, like real, actual, they've got frickin' technotronic devices, technotronic mind control. You ever heard of this stuff? It's freaky. The DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects, that works with the CIA has developed.
This is back in the like 70s, wasn't it?
No, no, no. This is
currently.
This is talking about currently. DARPA's still around today, and they were experimenting with a lot of these technologies for many decades. But what they got now is a lamppost. Okay, have you ever heard of the smart lamppost?
No.
No? Well, it's very interesting. They got speakers and cameras in them and little digital flags so that they can sell the space to advertisers and the lampposts. And they'll have smart light sensors as well. So if one side of the street is dark because the sun's going down but the other side isn't, one side of the lights will go on and the other side will stay off until it's completely dark, you know? Mm. And they've got these technotronic broadcasters in there that can actually pump out sound waves that actually affect your mind and can calm you and can either calm you or make you angry or whatever. There's a whole bunch of experimentation that's been done with this. So you've got the potential. Like, this is some of the real scary, like, conspiratorial stuff that some people get into, but a lot of people shy away from because they're too afraid of the implications. If you're too afraid of something, you usually refuse to admit that it exists. That's the denial phase. I admit that it exists, you know. That's why I encourage people to listen to my show every day. Because it's just the end of the world. You know, what are you going to worry about? You've got to have a bit of comedy to let yourself through these dark times. Because if you're hearing about scary stuff like that, and you're not having a few laughs while you're talking about it, that information ain't going to sink in. It's going to bang! Right off your third eye and just go cast back out into space and you'll forget about it, hopefully, for the rest of your life until it comes knocking at your door.